Session number 13580, reel number 3.
This is now reel 3.
Well, then, of course, we started to prepare for the spring offensive. We were taken back into the line, and I think it was the Reichwald Forest or Gok. We were soon back in action. We got dug in one night. Of course, everybody had to stand to for first light. All of a sudden, we heard the rattling of tanks and God knows what else. We thought, aye, aye. Counter attack coming. And all of a sudden, from behind us, we saw these tanks coming. Of course, everybody started shouting, and then somebody said it was all right, it's ours. So it was, I don't know the name of the regiment or what regiment it was, but it was Churchill tanks, and they passed through our lines. And disappeared. We didn't hear any more from them. And then we advanced. We came to a wood, which by this time we'd learnt woods can be very dangerous. Anyway, we came under fire and we got dug in. Return fire. Then the mortars, our battalion mortars, started firing, and we got mortared back with the morning binnies and things. And then we were ordered in to put an attack in on this position. I remember the sergeant getting killed. And then we advanced again. And
how did he get killed?
Machine gun fire, Spandau fire.
How did it happen? Did you see it?
Yes. We were running forward and he got hit. Billy Harmon, he threw a grenade at this spander nest, and it blew up. That got rid of those, and then we saw some Germans running. We fired after them. Eventually we went back to our platoon HQ, company HQ. We'd lost about 6 men there. And we're asked by the company commander to go out and bring these people back in who'd been killed. An officer and 6 men went out and brought them back in. And this Billy Harmon, who threw the grenade at the Stroop and threw the grenade at the Spandau position, was later given a medal, a Distinguished Service Medal, DCM, or Distinguished Conduct Medal.
Did he survive?
Yes, he's still living. Before that, we went on a patrol, and Jimmy Story, who was a professional boxer, stood on a shoe mine and blew his leg off. We managed to get him back. gone through this wood and cleared all that, and we were on our way to making our way, I think, towards Venlo. Or was it Venray?
Venlo.
Venlo. And we had to put another night attack in on a farm property. Which we made, and we didn't meet a great lot of resistance. We went, and we were always taught never to take a position that the German left. Always dig our own position away from wherever they dug in. So we were always taught to move away, because they always took plans of their positions, and they could pinpoint them with mortars. So we were always taught to move away from that position, not to use it, even in emergency, not to use it. Better to just dig yourself a small shell hole, which was just to get your body below the surface of the ground, or below the level of the ground. We did this, and of course it was night time, and we got dug in. And I remember seeing this patrol coming, and the forward position of our company opened fire on them. They returned the fire, and we saw them scatter and come towards our position. We opened fire, and they took off. One of the chaps in the forward position, he got killed. We were told to stand down, and we just left our normal sentries on, and the remainder went into this barn to brew up and just rest. We brewed up and had a cup of tea, and or if we had any tins of M&V, we got a biscuit tin and threw them all in and had something warm to eat. We stayed there all night. Of course, the company HQ, they took the building over the house. There was one or two Dutch people in, and they welcomed us, and the next morning we all went round and checked our weapons and cleaned up, and all of a sudden those four steps went up to a balcony. These steps opened up, and those six Germans walked out. They'd been in this all night, and we didn't know. So you can just imagine the surprise that we had when they walked out with hands on the shoulder, on their heads. We thought it was comical. We had a good laugh about it, but we all got a severe reprimand from the old man. But it was very well concealed. I mean, in the excitement, you didn't think that, well, we never come across it, steps underneath. And as I say, there was about six of them. Of course, we were looking for Lugers and anything else that we could lay our hands off before we handed them over to HQ. And
did you take their personal possessions from them?
Oh yeah, the watches, anything. Come on, let's have that ring, anything at all. Oh aye. Sometimes they'd ask for cigarettes, and sometimes they'd get one, depending how, what sort of mood, or how many people we'd lost. And from there we went, I think, on right up onto the River Rhine to Rees. And they laid a smoke screen down, and we were in this smoke screen for it must have been 3 weeks, and we had to patrol the river bank. On the other side of the river was Rees, and this is where they crossed the Rhine, and we patrolled that for three weeks or more in the smoke screen. We had to go down onto the river bank and patrol to make sure that there was no body coming over. And one night we were down, and we were inhabited. We took over farmhouses along the river, well back up the river, and we used to raid each other's hen houses, because if you killed your own fowl you didn't get any eggs, so we used to go on to the next platoons and raid theirs. And of course there was plenty of potatoes and things like that, and we were pretty well self-contained. I remember that my section, I was a corporal at the time, and they were all young lads. They didn't know how to kill poultry or clean it, and we'd been out all night on patrol and that. Anyway, they brought these three cockerels in to be killed. I thought I'd killed them, but they were still alive and they were under the bed, and what a time we had to catch them again. But we did, and we had a nice big pan full of chicken broth, and and we got a British Secret Service man. He'd come across, and he'd been in the German lines, and he had these two Germans with him. He was lucky he didn't get shot. He shouted that he was British, so they didn't open fire. The forward section didn't open fire. So we took him, we disarmed them, and took them to HQ, to company HQ, where they were interrogated, and eventually went back to battalion HQ, and we got the report back that he was a British Secret Service person who'd been behind the German lines in Rees, and these two Germans what was with him had helped him, and they'd brought them back to the comparatively safety, and that's, we didn't hear any more of that.
Was he in British uniform?
No, they were in German uniform. They were in German uniform.
All three of them?
Yeah. And as I say, when he said he was English and he spoke good English, we didn't take any chances. We took them in and disarmed them, checked them over. They had no more arms, and then eventually we took them to company HQ, and company HQ took them back to battalion HQ, and then they went back to echelon. As I say, the word come back that it was a British Secret Service, and they'd been behind the lines at Rees, preparing for, this is where they built the Bailey Bridge across the Rhine. And then one night about 5:30, by this time they'd brought all the artillery up along our positions, which was maybe a mile from the river bank. And the Middlesex came with a Vickers. Is it Vickers machine gun? All the mortars, all the heavy stuff behind us. About 5:30 that night, all hell let loose. In fact, it made a lot of our chaps a little bit bum happy. You could hear the shells coming, and the machine guns were going, the mortars were going. As I say, someone said it was a bigger barrage than the one at El Alamein. And we were ordered to go down and put tapes. And there was this lagoon, off the river, like a cutting. And we were told that we had to go down and put tapes up that they were going to cross that night.
Who was?
The forces doing the assault on over the Rhine to Rees. And we went down and put these tapes up, and we were told to stay there and give assistance to the Kangaroos with these troop carrying amphibious tanks, or whatever they call them. We knew them as Kangaroos. They took the troops across, and they went in one side and come out of the other of this cutting, or what we called the lagoon. And of course there was a counter attack. I went out to wave these tanks along this route that was marked with red tapes, and that night I got wounded. It wasn't a very bad wound, but I managed to stay with them until daybreak.
How did the wound happen?
It was a shell that dropped, and I got a small piece of shrapnel in my leg. When we got back, I was ordered to go to the fuel service station, and from there they sent me back up through the casualty clearing stations. We watched the Paris going in and over the Rhine. I finished up in the 111 British General Hospital in Brussels, where I was in there for about 3 weeks. And then I got sick leave, and this was the first leave. I was due leave, but I got sick leave because we'd not had any leave from D-Day. And
what did you think the treatment you got in the hospital?
Well, looking back, it was amusing. Of course, it was a military hospital. I felt ashamed, really, with some of the chaps who was in. The chap in the next bed to me, he'd been burnt badly in a tank. And the nurses gave me bandages to roll. But when they told you that the matron was coming round, you had to lay in your bed at attention. And she come round, and a real starchy old lady. And you had to lay to attention. And if she spoke to you, you had to, yes, madam, no, madam. Real smart. And then we got a blue suit, and we were allowed to go out into Brussels. And from there we got to sick leave. I came home. I think I had 7 days at home. And my leg had healed up. And went back to Ostend, East End, to an RTU. And then the war finished, and I returned back to my unit. They were at Recklinghausen, Dortmund. I returned back to my unit, and they'd come down from Bremerhaven down into the Ruhr, and there we stayed looking after displaced places, camps. We'd load them up on lorries and send them off. The next day they'd be back and they didn't want to go home.
And why didn't they want to go home?
Well, a lot of them were people who, I don't know whether they'd volunteered to work for the Germans or not, and of course there were one or two reprisals. And anyway, eventually,
what kind of reprisals?
Well, they cut the lady's hair off for collaborating, just sat them down, took all the hair off, and everybody shunned them.
Cut the hair of some DPs off?
Mm. And
a fellow DPs.
Fun.
The DPs did it to other DPs?
Yes, yeah, yeah. And of course there was a lot of these people from Ukraine, and they once they went back, we sent them to a marshalling yard for onward transport. As I say, they'd make their way back. They used to just take off. I mean, everything was in a chaos, you know, and nobody cared. The war was over. You weren't allowed to fraternise. We just took over places. We took over houses and built ourselves in houses and just moved the civilians out. And, of course, that's when the black market started. And even though there was no fraternisation, you did become friendly with the Germans, the German civilians, and for a packet of cigarettes you could get a bottle of Snaps. If you had any coffee, they'd give you anything for a kilo of coffee, ground coffee or bread. There was very few men around, only old people, old men. There were no young men anywhere around. But then, of course, we settled down and we become very active in the field of sport. We played inter sport with different companies, and rugby and boxing. We were allowed to go. There was a lovely swimming pool, indoor pool, and we were allowed to go in, providing there was no civilians there. At a certain time of the day, we went. We were training for brigade sports for swimming.
On the DPs, were you sympathetic with the DPs not wanting to go back?
Well, we just loaded them up and bunged them off again. We didn't have a lot of time for them. They were a poor sample. They lived in huts. They had the food. We provided them with rations. I suppose they thought, well, it's better to have something to eat and a comfortable bed than go somewhere or back to the wrong place and get either shot or whatever they did to them. I mean, they were pretty rough, were the Ukrainians and the Russians.
Did you ever guard them to take them back?
No, we just, as I say, we were in charge of the camp. We looked after the camp. And then we were ordered to send so many back. The trucks come and we put them on the trucks and they took them to these marshalling areas, which weren't very far away. And then, as I say, the next morning they'd be there again.
Did you ever speak to any of them?
Oh, yeah. Well, the best way you could. We couldn't speak German or...
What do you remember them saying to you?
Well, they used to ask for cigarettes, sweeties, chocolate, in broken English.
Did they ever say, don't send us back?
No. And there was quite a number of Italians amongst them. These camps were right out in the country, right away. In fact, it was a lovely country, you know, nice wooded areas.
This was Recklinghausen.
Yeah. And the place we were at was a little mining village, Erkenswick. And there was a mine there. And we used to go to the mine to use the showers. And of course, coming from a mining village, we inquired how they worked, and of course, all their mines were mechanised then, compared to ours, which you went in the mines here, you just had 6 yards of coal and you filled it off with a shovel. It was cut and blasted, but they had the Panzers, these coal cutting machines and things that, and the roads and things like that were much better than ours. I mean, they had the Autobahn. The mining villages were far superior to our villages. It did open your eyes. And you realised just how bad or how far we were behind the Germans. The swimming pool was a lovely pool. It was an indoor pool in this village, and they had a master shaft. He was an instructor, and he even taught us. He came and gave us tips for swimming and diving in Recklinghausen. That's where Battalion HQ was, and the winter sports there, or the summer sports, there was about 4 or 5 pools in one area. I mean, this was unheard of around here. Necessary.